Got an email from Ben Blacker the other day. Ben is the host of the Dead Pilots podcast here on Maximum Fun. He's the co-creator of the Thrilling Adventure Hour. He's a friend of mine. Hope you're hanging in all right, the email said. Please tell me how you are. Healthy, sane-ish, busy. Meanwhile, I'm writing to see if you would like to have John Ross Bowie as a guest on an upcoming Depression Mode episode. That's what Ben wrote to me, because that's what this is. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Ben is producing a new show called Household Faces, and it's hosted by John Ross Bowie. Interviews with character actors whose faces you know, but whose names you might not. Household Faces. John himself is kind of a household face. He played Kripke on Big Bang Theory for years. He starred on the show Speechless. His IMDb page goes on for days. You've seen him in many things. And I was like, yeah, of course, I'll talk to John Ross Bowie. I love John Ross Bowie. I've interviewed John Ross Bowie before about mental health, depression, and anxiety. And John is always eloquent. He is the one, John is, who told me when the pandemic started with the isolation and the fear, he said, hey, this is the depressed person's time to shine. We've all been training for this our whole lives. All of these feelings that the people without depression are feeling, we're veterans at this. Finally, our skills and our training can be put to good use. So that's great. Plus, John's a legit real friend of mine. I love the guy. So yeah, I want to talk to him. So we set up a time and I talked to him. And the thing is, sometimes if you have a good interview subject, the topic of the interview reveals itself after you start rolling. When I talked to John, it became apparent to me as we went along that he's been an actor for many years, and there's something about that that is universally applicable to everybody who's not an actor right now. Because acting in Hollywood, TV, movies, operates in a gig economy setting. You don't have a cubicle and a desk at the acting corporation, no regular paychecks. Now you go from gig to gig. And that, we're often told, is going to be more and more the case in the regular economy for everybody. And for a lot of people, they're thinking, well, I didn't sign up for a gig economy. I don't want this. I signed up to have stability, security. So in the same way that non-depressed people could learn from people who were already there, which John had said about the beginning of COVID, let's learn how to psychologically handle the gig economy from someone who has been handling it for a while and is prone to depression already and seems to be holding up okay. So that's John Ross Bowie coming up here in mere moments. After John, I'm going to talk with Maura Ahrens Mealy. She's from the Harvard Business Review, talking about how to get your brain, which might be one of those interesting and unusual brains prone to bumpiness, how to get that brain ready to handle the oncoming gig economy and how to even thrive and be happy, not just endure it, but prosper. John Ross Bowie says his gigs have changed with his age and his hair color, which are factors he could not control.
I definitely had a spike in work when I went gray.
Really?
And I went gray in my, like, seriously started to go gray in my early 40s. Uh-huh. And a lot of it was actually emotionally connected, because I don't forget what podcast I'm on. But a lot of it was just like a lot of stress that was going on at home and stuff. And all this silver started to crop up. And people seemed to then recognize that, oh, he could actually be a father. Because my 30s were this weird spell where once I aged out of like goofy grad student or paralegal or whatever, there was just this weird spell where I was playing suspects who were quickly dismissed as not being competent enough to have actually committed the crime. And I'm not exaggerating when
it's
I tell you,
feel great.
It was, there was once every 3 months in an audition, I would have to deliver the line, "You guys think I killed her?" And I'm not, I swear to God, I'm not exaggerating, John. Like I said that so much that I would put myself on tape and my wife would just crack up and I'd be like, "We have to go again." Because you're cracking up at the fact that I have once again said, "You guys think I killed her?" So that was my 30s were just this, I don't know what to do with this guy. He's like, he's too old to be a grad student, but I don't want to see him raise kids. And then I let myself go gray. Not as like a real conscious decision. I just didn't feel like dyeing my hair. And it opened things up. And then, you know, some slightly more academic roles started to roll in. And I got to play a dad several times on some shows that actually had some footing.
John says his job requires a thick skin. But people with depression don't always have that kind of skin. If you want to make a living in entertainment, in acting, let's say, how do you limit that and say, you know, I'm going to like this, but I'm not going to let it consume me. I'm going to participate in this, but I'm not going to hinge my sense of self-worth and value as a human being on whether I get to play, you know, construction worker number two in this TV show or not. Is that something that you have developed a method for? Is that something that you've learned a method for? Or is that something instinctive that you have?
Oh, it's certainly not instinctive. Boy, is it not instinctive. And this business broke my heart a lot when I was just starting out. Yeah. But there's a couple things that I did, and I'm loath to give advice, but here's a couple things that I did. One, I made sure that I was always doing other shit. That I was always, at the very least, messing around with my guitar or going for a bike ride or something to clear the head and make sure I have other hobbies that don't even have to be monetized, just things I am doing that that keep me from just being an actor. The other thing that was really good for me, and I recommend this to actors all the time, see if you can get yourself into the other side of an audition. Even if you're just like hanging out with a casting director and reading for them or just sitting in the room while they're auditioning. Because what's great about that is you see how many good people come in for one role. Mm. And how many people come in and are excellent, but there's just something that isn't there and somebody else has that thing. But that doesn't take anything away from the six or seven other people who came in and read the shit out of this part. And once you do that a couple of times, and I've been fortunate enough to do that a couple of times, you realize that casting is an inexact science and there's absolutely nothing personal about it. You just can't. You cannot tie your identity up into this stuff because there are people who it's a numbers game. It's a question of how many times you get up to bat. There's so many variables that come into casting someone. And it's not like there's some sort of ledger that we all have laid out in front of us that goes, well, this person checks boxes 3 through 5, so therefore it's a go. You know, it can be as vague as, you know, he's so much shorter than his female lead, it would be distracting and it would change the arc of the story, you know. Mm-hmm. Which, as someone who is only 5'8", it has come up. So the idea of looking around the business and seeing all the things that go into it has calmed me down dramatically. And it's something I didn't get around to doing until my late 30s, really. Mm. Getting around to like looking at this, the decisions that go into casting that are not done from a place of cruelty. And sometimes they're heartbreaking. And sometimes the casting director is like, oh God, I wish I could hook John up with this thing, but I got to go with blank or blank. For myriad reasons that have nothing to do with me or my talent or my self-worth or my value. It also helps if, you, like me, you have tried to have other jobs and were not good at them. So you really have a keen sense of like, no, this is the last stop on the career train, John. Better make it work.
Were you not good at them because it's not what you really wanted to be doing, or did you just suck?
Yes and yes. I think there was a part of me deep down that knew I just wanted to be an actor. But I really did put my best foot forward for teaching when I taught high school for exactly 1 year. And it broke me like a twig. But I really I gave it the old college try, having been just out of college.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think it was a real sense of you know, this gig is beneath me or anything like that. I think there was a genuine strain of incompetence running through a lot of what I was doing in my 20s.
That can help you make career decisions if you follow
your own path. That's my other chunk of advice. Be terrible at something so you can find out what you're good at.
I find when I've been in professional situations where I'm just in the wrong shoes, where I'm just in the wrong place. This happened when I was at Amazon.com and I'd go on business development meetings.
Oh, I've gone on those. They're weird.
They're weird as hell. And the same thing started to happen and I finally embraced it, which is at some point I started to just imagine a monkey playing the drums. That you know, certain amount of lingo gets used, some acronyms get tossed around, and then a monkey is playing the drums, usually in a black and white film and usually in a kind of loop.
Yeah, yeah. And is it just the one drum, or is it a little more of a one-man band thing where he's got like two crash cymbals on his knees, or?
No, it's a kit. It's like a very basic kit. It's like Lee Rocker's kit.
The guy from Violent Femmes?
No, Lee Beautiful. Rocker and Stray Cats.
Fantastic. I was going to say the guy from the Violent Femmes. I'll allow both.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you know my monkey oeuvre that I'm talking about.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm asking about these things, one, because it's nice to talk to you, but also, two, because even though most of the people who will listen to this aren't going to go to Hollywood and try to be actors, but they exist in their own world of questioning their occupations, questioning their career choices, existing in competitive environments. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me to see how the people that we regularly see on TV and film are going through these same things, because I think so much of it is pretty universal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we, by virtue of the fact that we have been in a gig economy for eternity, since the ancient Greeks were putting masks and phalluses on to do Aristophanes, we have been in the gig economy. So everyone, when you know the article started popping up a couple years ago about what is this gig economy, most actors were like, yeah, you new here? How are you?
when COVID hit and we were like, what's it like to be depressed? We're like, oh, honey, come on in.
Strap in. It's okay. It's okay. Get yourself a nice pillow. I think there is a steadier stream of uncertainty in my line of work, but I know for a fact that even if you aren't living audition to audition, there's going to be moments of self-doubt and moments of fear and anxiety, and that come from your job, whether it's the right career for you or not. And again, I think the key thing is to make sure that your job isn't the only thing about you. Mm. You know, that you are doing other things. I always worry about people who go, oh, the theater is my church. I'm like, listen, I love acting, but I take care of yourself, man. You know, don't do some things that aren't your church, you know? Get out of your church occasionally. Don't get too dogmatic with this stuff, because it's not the most reliable line of work, and you should have other things going on.
That's John Ross Bowie. Look him up. His last name is spelled like David Bowie, but it's pronounced like the island of Maui. Just ahead, okay, we have some of these lessons in the bag from a Hollywood actor, where all important life lessons come from. How do we put it into practice? How do we make that kind of mindset work in the gig economy? Maura Ahrens-Mealy joins us from the Harvard Business Review for an illuminating conversation about work, mental health, and really, life. Maura Ahrens-Mealy is with us. She's the host of the Anxious Achiever podcast for the Harvard Business Review, which is an excellent podcast that you must check out. Maura, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks, John.
You know, we've been talking about the economy and where jobs are going and all those things that are more than economic issues. They're hitting close to home. There aren't a lot of gold watches being given out for 50 years of service anymore. People move around and employers dump their workers when it's convenient. We start using phrases like gig economy. And a lot of it seems to come down to managing one's idea of being in control of a situation, which seems very personal. Has that been your observation?
Absolutely. I think the loss of the illusion of control is going to be one of like the big existential stories of our time. Of course, the pandemic, right? Yeah, we didn't see that one coming. Like Right. Our whole lives changed overnight. Everything feels precarious and different. And we as humans hate feeling precarious.
Yeah.
It is not what our brains like. And it's funny, when you suggested this topic, I got to thinking and I thought, you know, the whole definition of the gig economy, but let's broaden it maybe to being a freelancer, self-employed, even an entrepreneur, is really about precarity. And that's really hard.
Like even thinking about it as freelancing, gig economy, entrepreneurship, it's promising in one sense of, hey, this, you know, this is a whole new world of a self-determined life.
Like I'm sexy.
It's sexy. I'm rowing the boat and navigating the boat. But it's enormous, especially at a time too when so many people have had to work from home and blend the idea of a workplace and a home place together and, you know, knock over that boundary.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and I think that one of the problems about working for either yourself or being a gig worker is that it is boundary crushing because you are left to your own devices. And you know, I've been reading about the delivery workers in New York City sort of revolting and standing up for their rights and reading about what their days were like, literally trying to game a system of apps while sitting in traffic in New York City, never being able to actually go to the bathroom because they might miss a job, right? I mean, talk about boundary crushing. And even those of us who are, you know, more privileged, more professional, are not sort of, you know, facing dangerous New York City traffic to earn a living every day. Working for yourself can be very boundary crushing in a way that working in an organization, it's just different. It's lesser.
Yeah. I've, in the last year and a half, found the convenience of my commute being a few steps across across the floor. But, you know, and like, oh, if I really want to get this thing done, I could just do it at 10 o'clock at night. But also, it's really messed with me in ways that I wasn't really expecting. Have you had that experience, too, of like, you know, the loss of those boundaries? And what's that done for you?
Oh, my God. Well, you know, what's interesting is, so I started working for myself in 2006, so a long time ago. And I sold my company in May. And so now I've been working for someone else as I sort of complete the earnout of the sale of my business. And it has been the rudest wake-up call to try to fit into someone else's system. And what do you mean I can't email right now? This is when I work best.
Right.
Well, Maura, you have a team now and they don't care that 2 a.m. works for you. Like, it's not appropriate, right? So on one level, I can be like, oh, wow, I developed some really bad habits as an entrepreneur. On the other level, the thing that's really scary about working for yourself is that you only have yourself to trust at the end of the day. And if you're an anxious person like I am, and if you're a depressive like I am, every day you're at battle because you don't trust yourself to do a good job.
You're in a battle against yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're your own worst employee as well as being the boss.
Oh my God. Well, I'm the worst employee. I would never want to work for me.
So, I mean, as someone then who pays a lot of attention to this stuff and someone who's been kind of on various different sides of it, what would you tell people is the first step on the path from terror to confidence? Give us some driving directions on what to do.
Well, I will say that even though being self-employed is the worst of times, it really is the best of times if you can make it work. And I actually wrote a book a lot about this topic. So my book is called Hiding in the Bathroom. It's my first book. I'm working on a new book about anxiety and leadership. But Hiding in the Bathroom is really a guide for people who prefer to hide in the bathroom than network, schmooze, get out there, sell business, go to the office, but who are really driven and ambitious. And so here's the thing. A lot of it comes down to money. You need to know how much money you need every single month. I call this your monthly nut. Whether you are a gig worker just trying to make it work, or you've quit your job and you're ready to start out as a freelancer, you need to be realistic and clear-eyed about your monthly nut. And again, a lot of us have anxiety around money.
Yes.
Like money is, I would say, one of the top 2-3 triggers for anxiety and bad feelings that we most of us have. And when you're not getting a paycheck anymore, you have to sort of practice being rational about money, which is really hard. And so you got to have a number. And when you know your number, it's actually easier.
Yeah. And then what about just dealing with the uncertainty? You know, as an anxious person, what have you found that works? What have you found that doesn't work in dealing with the anxiety of being in the jungle now economically?
Well, right. The jungle economically and then the jungle of your own mind.
Yeah.
You know, this is where I think it really comes down to two things. And one sounds kind of cheesy and woo-woo, and one is really, really practical. The cheesy and woo-woo is it has to be rooted in some sort of values that you have as a person. And again, I'm saying this with a fair amount of privilege. I understand that a lot of people who are doing gig work are doing it, you know, because they don't have a choice. But I was reading a study of musicians in the UK, which was one of the first studies of the effect of mental health in the gig economy. And what it found was that it was actually the work of being an aspiring musician that hurt these musicians' mental health so much. Yet at the same time, they were so driven to be musicians. A lot of them couldn't imagine being anything else. And so it's really about understanding why you're doing this work. And it could be, I'm doing this work because I need to feed my children. And it could be, I'm doing this work because I have a vision and I really need to execute on it because otherwise I will be miserable the rest of my life. But you cannot wake up every day and work for yourself in all the precarity without at least having that clear vision to come back to, because it will get you through hard times. So that's the woo-woo part. The second piece is you got to build in guardrails or infrastructure. And this is really, really important. And knowing your monthly nut is kind of the first essential piece, right? Because you have to have your financial infrastructure in place. But you have to think about your day in a very, very concrete way. I have a kid with ADHD. And the coolest thing I've learned about working with him, and he's got an incredible ADHD coach in our school system, and she helps him manage his time in a way that I, as a depressive and an anxious person, but also as a freelancer, would have so greatly benefited from, because it's so concrete and it's so specific and it doesn't allow for the time to sort of ruminate and freak out and doubt yourself. But it also builds in breaks. And I think that as a freelancer, you have to treat time differently and you have to look at your day. If when you're alone, it makes you ruminate and worry too much, don't work alone. Go work in a coffee shop. Go find people to be with. Like, take the actual mechanics of your day very seriously.
Mm. It's not just a preference. It's not just like a whim of how you're feeling. But, you know, I might feel like I need to be with other people, but come on, get down to business. You work alone. It's valuing the things that your brain is saying to itself.
Yeah. Like, I don't know if you have this experience, John, but the weird thing about working at home when you have a sort of ruminating brain is you just have a lot more space for it, right?
Yeah.
And that's really tricky.
Right. For me, the hardest thing about it is that my dogs would always like to take a nap with me. And they always think that's a really great idea. So if I walk anywhere near the bedroom, they hop up on the bed and invite me to join them. And
they're like the devil, the sirens calling you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and my therapist said, it's okay to do that sometimes, but set a timer. Don't just spend the whole day there. I want to ask about the woo-woo part a little bit. Is that something where one would be well served to sit down and write down what their code is, like what their credo, what the thing is that they're working for, and, you know, memorize that, pin it to the wall in front of them? Like, does that kind of thing help that reinforcement?
100%. Yeah. 100%. In fact, I'm such a big fan of like the personal credo. I have a good friend who actually just started working in an organization after many years of self-employment too. And she got a giant pink post-it note and it says, "How will I evolve today?" Because she's working in a really challenging organization, right? And so it's like, how will I evolve today? And that's her credo. And so, yeah, I think that you have to have your why, because it will be hard and you will doubt yourself. And, you know, some people, God bless them, like seem to wake up in the morning and be full of energy and just think, I can do this. And so you have to have that sort of proof of concept to fall back on. You might even want to have a folder of really great work. Like, I bet, John, that you have some pieces of audio that you're super proud of, right? From over the years.
Sure.
Or you've won an award, right? And it can even be helpful to sort of reflect and listen to that work when you're feeling overwhelmed and doubtful.
Yeah, I mean, I find it, I get letters, I've been blessed to get a lot of letters and emails and tweets and messages over the years. And I always know where those are. You know, I always know when, where those are on hand. And I can reach for it, because so often, I think this isn't unique to podcasting or to creative work in general, but, you know, I always tell people, I sit in this little room and I talk into a microphone, and then I just have to take it on faith that people are listening somewhere. And, yeah, you know, so when you get like a blip, you get like a signal from the other planet, it's very exciting.
I'll tell you what, I've been actually really depressed for the past probably 8-9 months, and it's getting worse. And I was on the phone with my mom this morning, and I was crying, and I was just like, you know, I hate my brain. And I got a message on LinkedIn after I got off the phone with my mom, and it was a woman in South America who was like, your work has changed my life. And as much as I do sometimes hate my brain, it's really, it is that feeling of, you know, it's not all for naught. And that sounds grandiose, but like any way that you can sort of check in with your why and your purpose. And sometimes I remember when I was a consultant working for myself for all those years, and I would fly all the time, and I hate to fly. I have terrible flying anxiety. I hate to leave my kids. But like, I had to support those kids. I didn't really have a choice. And that was a why that I came at every runway I sat on. I swear to God. Every runway where it was like, we're going to take off and I'm going to die, it would be like, Maura, you are not doing this for fun.
Every story about work, about employment, about business is ultimately a story about people trying to figure out how they're going to go through their days. More with Maura Ahrens-Mealy in a moment.
Hi, it's me, Dave Hill, from Before, here to tell you about my brand new show on Maximum Fun, the Dave Hill Good Time Hour, which combines my old Maximum Fun show, Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, with my old radio show, The Goddamn Dave Hill Show, into one new futuristic program from the future. If you like delightful conversation with incredible guests, technical difficulties, and actual phone calls from real-life listeners, you've just hit a street called easy. I'm also joined by my incredible co-host, the boy criminal Chris Gersbeck. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, Dave. It's really great.
That's enough, Chris. And New Jersey chicken rancher, Dez. Say hi, Dez.
Hey, Dave.
The Dave Hill Good Time Hour. Brand new episodes every Friday on Maximum Fun.
Plus, the show's not even an hour. It's 90 minutes.
Take that, stupid rules.
We nailed it.
Hi, I'm Joe Firestone.
And I'm Manolo Moreno.
And we host After Game Show, a podcast where listeners submit games and we play them regardless of quality with a dozen listeners from around the world.
We've had folks call in from as far as Sweden, South Africa, and the Philippines.
Here's an example. This is the game we call Zooey Deschanel, where you turn a celebrity's name into an animal pun. You have an example, Manolo?
Brad Gorilla Pit.
Oh, that's a pun on gorilla pits?
Yep.
I don't know.
That's Brad Pitt.
Oh, okay.
That's a high quality game that you could expect.
Dr. Game Show has new episodes every other Wednesday on Maximum Fun.
Check us out, please.
Back with Maura Ahrens Mealy from Harvard Business Review, still talking about your mind and the gig economy, but also more than that. Remember when I said sometimes the topic reveals itself once the conversation is happening? So this has become an episode about how we live and work and really manage ourselves. I always tell people that I couch it a little bit. I say, I've met plenty of my heroes, and by and large, it's gone great. You know, because I guess I don't make them into too much of heroes or just people I admire. You know, and I always tell people, if you feel strongly about the work that someone has done and its positive impact on you, drop them a note. It's so easy. A message, a little tweet here and there. It really does make a difference. You know, no matter if it's in the arts or in media or some other walk of life, a coffee shop you went to. And I wonder, too, if that is a sort of growing currency in a world where we're often more separated, at least physically, at least in meat space from each other, that those are just really valuable lifelines in the world we're living in and in the economy we're entering into.
Well, right. So the reputation economy is also the gig economy.
Yeah.
And this is, it's so, I'm glad you brought this up because this is the double-edged sword. I'm an internet Pollyanna. Online community has basically been my whole life. I started working in online community when I was with Hillary Clinton at iVillage.com, you know, in the 90s. And I am a big believer in the community and connectivity that we find online. However, when you look at data of precarious mental health of gig workers, it's their need to always be online, whether it's waiting for that app or it's building your personal brand, which, oh my God, we can talk about, that also makes them so anxious and depressed. But Julie Lithcott-Hames, who's a really wise person and an author, she has this theory that reaching out with acts of gratitude and kindness is one of the best things that we can do to build our own sense of resilience and gratitude in the world. And I shared an example with her where, you know, we live on a really busy road, and like I was scared to put my little girl on the bus because she'd have to cross the really busy road and people are really rude. They don't care that there's a school bus. And the bus driver in my district worked and remapped the bus route so that she could be dropped off and picked up safely. And I started to cry. And I sent the Department of Transportation in my town a note, and I tweeted it, and I went crazy with my thanks because I was so grateful. And Julie, like when we did an interview together, and she lifted that up because she said, you know, it's that act of gratitude that really builds the web of connectivity for all of us when we're lonely. And I really think that's true. And so the downside is that I have to constantly be worrying that I don't have enough followers, which is going to literally cost me money. The upside is that I can tweet the Department of Transportation and our school superintendent, and it has a ripple effect to employees who don't often get thanked.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, you touched on the idea of building brands. And I got to admit, it's a phrase that from the first time I heard it years ago, I was like, that is gross. Building a personal brand of me as if I was Clorox or Oreo cookies or something, because it felt very commodified. Like, you know, yeah. I have to turn myself into an object to be marketed. But at the same time, these directions that we're going seems like the brand, there's an opportunity to make the brand more humane, more interwoven with other humans in a way that's kind of meaningful and empowering at the same time.
I mean, I have to push back on you that a personal brand is gross, because I think it's just how things are.
Yeah.
You know, like we are media, as Gary Steingart wrote. And you are media, John. Like, that's who you are, and that's how you're going to either, you know.
Yes, but I'm self-loathing more.
But that's your authentic brand.
Yes.
Like, we are media, and we have to suck it up and accept it and play the game. I mean, look, I hate it too, because I'm an introvert and I'm anxious, and every time I post something, it makes me nauseous inside. But then I'm like, well, what's the alternative? If I want to keep this independence and flexibility and do the work I love, I sort of have to play the game. And that sucks. But again, it comes back to the why.
Right, right. It's it requires a lot of conscious thought. There are a couple things that require a lot of conscious thought. One,
does your Twitter require a lot of conscious thought?
Sort of.
I love your Twitter.
Thank you. But like, I always say that to manage a chronic mental disorder, challenge, obstacle, whatever you want to call it, I don't usually use the word illness anymore, but like, to manage your life in that world requires conscious thought. Like, okay, this is the lie my depression is telling me right now. Here's how I steer around that. And I know there are people in the world who just do that automatically. I can't. I need to say, oh, okay, this is a distortion. This is a habit that I've gotten into. This is an old way of thinking. I need to redirect. And sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it makes you really sleepy because it takes so much energy.
So much.
But the other thing too is my daughter listened to me do some tracking, some narration at the top and bottom of the episode. And she said, that doesn't sound like you. And it really hurt, because I'm like, oh, but I try to be sincere. You know, she's like, oh no, you're sincere. That's not the guy I usually talk to. And so I'm always struggling with how to consciously manage those different voices in the professional and personal and liminal between personal and professional. It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work to have brains like ours, period. But did your daughter mean that you sounded happier than normal or less happy? Or like, what do you think she meant? It doesn't sound like you.
I think she meant that I sounded more focused, that I was, you know, really trying to convey a particular thing, and that I was really kind of bearing down. Not so much that I was more serious, but that I was, putting on a professional tone and sounded, you know, concerned and sympathetic, empathetic. Mm. And usually with her, I think I'm all those things, but I'm also like, hey, did you take the trash out like I asked you to?
Right.
You know, hey, you got some math to do tonight, right? Go do your math.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like that would happen even if you went to show up at a boardroom and she went to a board meeting and you were like standing up in front of the room, like presenting, she'd be like, whoa, is that my dad? You know, so it's like when our kids see our professional selves, it's always sort of interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah.
My husband said to me yesterday, we had like a serious sit down about my mental health, and he was like, you fake it so well. And it took me, you fake it so well, I didn't even realize how serious this was until he had a window into me, he said Sunday night. But he was like, you are so good at faking it.
Hmm.
And I was like, yeah, gotta be.
Do you think it's faking it?
Being hyper-functional while also being depressed?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Is it a skill?
Is it pretense? Is it not your real self? Is there a definitive real self? Or are they all just facets of the same thing?
They're facets. And it's what I've learned working for myself for 15 years is, you know, like, I got to show up in that meeting. I got to show up on that podcast. I have to show up. I think that when you kind of get very good at turning on a dime and putting on the face and being, I call it my sort of like adult Mora. Uh-huh. You know, and maybe that's what your daughter was reacting to.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. To bring it back around to the gig economy idea, or the freelancing, or the kind of, we're all kind of on our own more than we used to be, or at least we're realizing how all alone we always were, but it's being brought into sharper relief. Is it imperative upon somebody participating in this economy to then get a grip on all those things, to know exactly who the human is that they're dealing with?
Themselves, you mean?
Yeah.
The human being themselves. Look, John, I think that is the key issue of why we're all so shitty at work and in our relationships, is that we don't actually know how to understand the human that is ourselves.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Every time your boss keeps emailing you at midnight because she's so anxious, that is a true enactment of her not understanding herself, or just not knowing how, or not taking the time. So, like, to me, that is the work that we all need to do. The thing is that if you have a comfortable, cushy job that you've had for a while, you can get away with a lot. But when you work for yourself, you just can't.
Right.
So you got to do that work.
Yeah, yeah. If I go take a nap with the dogs, the entire company is napping with dogs right now. This top to bottom. Look at the flowchart of the organization.
I don't pay you to
sleep,
John.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. At least the dogs are doing something, you know. They're working for their food.
But on the flip side, how awesome is it that you can take a nap,
yeah,
right? Like, how amazing is it that you can take a nap? And, you know, data shows that, like, napping is really good. So maybe the takeaway is not don't nap. It's structure the time when you're going to nap so that you can nap guilt-free and enjoy the benefits of being flexible.
Yeah, put that in your article, Harvard Business Review.
power napping.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, I kind of saw this issue a little bit more narrowly before we started talking, but the idea of this independent economy or you know, a workforce that is knocking down some boundaries, it's, you know, accepting the more fragile nature of any particular spot of employment. It is empowering in a sense because it is about the individual person that you're working for, as opposed to, like, knocking yourself out to enrich a corporation or to please a boss in some way, in a way that you can't completely verify or understand. In many ways, it's a lot more empowering, isn't it?
I think it is. I mean, again, I don't think it is if you're working for Uber Eats and they take 30%. And,
right.
You know, like, I think we have to draw that line. On the other hand, if you are the kind of person who's, like, in your heart needs independence, which many of us are, I think that that's a valid reason to not go work for an organization. You just have to accept that with the independence is going to come some hard work.
Maura Ahrens-Mealy, I hope you find some strength, and I hope you receive some of the love that you are due and that's out there in the world for you.
Oh, thanks, John.
Okay. Well, we have links. Read some of Maura's articles. They're on our show page. Just go to MaximumFun.org, navigate to our show, and good luck out there. By the way, if I was your boss, I'd be impressed with your work. And I'd be surprised to be your boss, because I do not remember hiring you. And let's do another meditation moment with our friend Laura House. She's the co-host of Tiny Victories, the podcast here on the Maximum Fun Network. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
And we're just going to take just a minute or so here to do a meditation. And two things that I've gathered from your teachings, Laura. One, there's going to be some periods of silence. Do not be alarmed. It's not what you're used to hearing on the radio or podcast, but it's okay here. You're in a safe place. And two, there's really no way to do this wrong. Mm-mm. Anybody can do this and be just fine at it.
Yeah, it's really just a letting go. So we'll start by just closing your eyes. If you're in a place where you can sit with your back against something, that's good. Just be as comfortable as you can. Close your eyes. And we're just giving our brain a little bitty job. Just notice that you're breathing. You might not have noticed it today or for a while, but you're doing it anyway, so you're just sort of noticing. just sort of let it happen and just let go. Okay, go ahead and slowly open your eyes. Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed your respite from stress life.
I know I did. It's funny. It's not so much coming out of it and being like relaxed. It's more like just being more present. Like you're not like falling asleep. You're just, you know, more in your own body and your own world.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not meant to be. I think sometimes we feel like it's supposed to feel like an acid trip or something. And it's like, no, yeah. Just feel a little better.
Yeah. Yeah. It's accomplishable. Laura House, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, after Ivan Maisel's son died by suicide, the option was there to just keep it all to himself. Ivan declined that option.
One of the things I figured out about this whole process, John, early on was that I couldn't stay with Max, that I had to keep living and I had to keep going, that I could experience joy again. If I didn't experience joy again, then Max's death would cheat me twice, cheat me doubly. You know, the fetal position was really comfortable, but you can't live in the fetal position.
Ivan Maisel on Loss and Love. If people support our show through small donations, or heck, large donations, we can keep being here together. If not, we can't. If you donate, you make Depression Mode happen, and I thank you. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. You can find a level that works for you. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join. Did you know that I wrote a book? It's called The Hilarious World of Depression, and it's a memoir. You find out about me, and a lot of people tell me it's helped them a ton with their mental health, and that makes me glad, because that's why I wrote it. The Hilarious World of Depression makes a great gift to give to someone else this holiday season, or, heck, a great gift that you can give to yourself. And you could wrap it, and you could act surprised. It's available where books are sold, of course. Be sure to hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do it now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. I want you to know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. You can reach us through our electric mail address, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram @DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter, that's available on Substack. Search it up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMoe. Hello, Credits listeners. Thank you for listening to Credits. I love raisins so much that if someone put them on a pizza, I would try that pizza. But I will never put raisins on a pizza myself because I'm not a monster. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason. Maybe there's no reason. I just keep believing. No one knows the answer. Maybe there's no answer. I just keep on dancing.
Hi, I'm Maggie from Boston. And I want you to know that I am rooting for you, and I am very proud of you.
Depresh Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.